supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. A timely question of the week for you this time out. Cats and kittens, when is it safe to pick your tomatoes? Is there any advantage or disadvantage to picking them a little early? Exactly what stages do they go through as they achieve that final ripeness? We will answer all those questions after lots of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Mike. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yourself?
I am just ducky today. Where is the other Mike doing well?
I'm doing well in Westfield, Indiana.
Very good, sir. What can we do for you?
Well, I bought a cedar raised bed garden because I can't get out in my regular gardens here due to some health issues.
Right.
It's on raised on legs. It's about 3 foot long, foot and a half wide, about 8 inches deep. Planted it in May with lettuce, spinach, carrots, a start of Swiss chard, a broccoli plant, and a cherry tomato plant. I used organic fertilizer at the recommended rate, a 2-4-7 mix, and everything grew except the spinach. It grew about 1 inch, and then it stopped growing.
Now, you're saying a raised bed, but really what you have is one of these garden containers that's up on legs. It's a raised bed up in the air, like 2-3 feet off the ground.
Exactly. It's 2.5 feet off the ground.
Yeah, I love these things. What did you fill it with?
I filled it with premium potting soil from a local garden center that I've done business with for years.
When you planted the seeds, I presume, did you know to soak the soil first really thoroughly?
Yes.
And then lay the seeds on top and then cover them with a thin layer of more of the potting soil and then gently mist those till everything came up.
Right.
And you're saying the spinach came up and died?
The spinach didn't even come up. The lettuce and the carrots came up, grew about 1 inch and stopped growing. And the Swiss chard, the broccoli, and the tomato have just sat there and done nothing.
Did you have any unusual weather? You said you planted them in May. What part of May?
Late May.
Okay.
Our weather has been a little warmer than usual and a little rainier than usual.
What was the organic fertilizer?
Job's 2-4-7 bagged organic fertilizer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they're a former chemical company that has an organic line. They were famous for those stakes that you put in the ground for trees. Well, how much sun are these plants getting?
They're getting full sun. It's on the south side of our house, so it gets full sun from morning till evening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's great air circulation.
Many of the plants succumbed, but none of the plants are doing better than the others?
Correct.
I would go out and I would get a nice liquid organic fertilizer and try feeding the plants with that. You fed it once, right?
Yeah, I fed it when I planted everything, and then I side-dressed everything about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you don't feed seed for the future. Seed actually is plant food. When you grow plants from seed, you wait until they have their first set of true leaves before you give them any food, and then you give them very diluted food.
Oh.
But no, I mean, the food you described, the levels of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, especially if they're in a natural form, they shouldn't have done this. Do you have access to any good compost?
Yeah, I do.
Get the liquid fertilizer, but the first thing I would do is put an inch of compost on the surface of the soil and see if that perks the plants up, because mine are growing like crazy, and you know, if yours were getting too much sun, they'd be showing other symptoms. I can't imagine what's going on here. But the first thing you're going to try is compost. And then if you get a nice little positive reaction from that, use a nice balanced liquid fertilizer? Do you have support for the tomato, or is it just a cherry tomato that's going to trail?
It's a cherry tomato that's going to trail.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do you have flowers on the cherry yet?
There were flowers when I planted it. None of them produced tomatoes, and they all fell off, and I haven't had any flowers since.
Oh, okay. So it was in bloom when you planted it.
Right.
Yeah, that's understandable then for that plant. A lot of times when you buy these plants, and especially if you plant them first thing in the morning, then they go through a lot of transplant shock on a hot day, they can lose all those flowers and go through a little bit of shock. The good part is you've still got a nice long season left. So don't panic. Compost, a little bit of liquid fertilizer, and you know maybe light a candle to the Blessed Mother.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, sir.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Now, I'm going to do my best here. Barbara O., is that your name?
Barbara O.
Barbara O. Barbara O., welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Wow. Thank you, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Barbara O. How are you doing?
I think I'm in the same camp you're in.
Okay, and where is your camp?
Dayton, Ohio.
So what can we do for Barbara O. in Dayton?
Poison ivy. I've been out of my little cottage for a couple of years dealing with a family member who passed and getting things out of her house. In the meantime, poison ivy has invaded my house. It's grown around the side. It's grown up the side of the house. And in the front at the door, there's just a little bush as if it's flowers, and it's not flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I get rid of the poison ivy?
Well, the basic answer is, first of all, don't use herbicides, because although herbicides will make the plant look dead, it'll still contain all of the oil that gives people the rash. The basic answer is if you are up for it or if you can hire somebody to do it, the smartest thing to do is work small areas at a time,
okay.
Totally saturate the soil with water, really soak the area that the poison ivy is in. And then if it's just normal size poison ivy plants, you take shopping bags, like good heavy bags from the mall.
Okay.
You slide one bag over each hand, and then you grab a hold of the poison ivy vine down at the soil line, and you pull very slowly out of soaking wet soil until you get all of it out, all of the root, and then you wrap the bags down over top of each other and throw those bags into a trash bag. And then you repeat using fresh bags, always making sure the soil is saturated. That way, you don't touch the poison ivy. You also don't get it on gloves or clothing or anything like that. And
Okay. If
accidentally sometimes those vines can whip back at you and hit you in the arm or something. If it touches bare skin, finish up what you're doing, pull that plant, and then go have a garden hose there. And then just use the garden hose to clear the area real well with cool water. Cool water alone dissolves the oil.
Oh, really?
Yes. But if you use hot water, it will actually help it penetrate your skin faster.
Wow, the world needs to know that.
Yes. So cool water alone, no wash rag, no soap, because then you get the oil on the soap and the wash rag. You know, just
Okay. Use
your hands to wipe the area with cool water, then wash your hands real well. And if you think you exposed any of your clothing, when you go into the house, throw all your clothes into a cold water wash.
Okay.
Now, if there's a lot of it and it's big, you may want to hire a landscaper to come out. And we have a guy here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area, who's created his own company called I Don't Want Poison Ivy. And this guy runs symposiums. He's probably become one of the best poison ivy researchers and most knowledgeable people on the planet. And he has a company that has guys come out in the Tyvek suits that they use to work in chemical environments and stuff.
Right. Okay.
And they pull it all and they take it away. And his name is Umar. If you can't find anybody to do it, go to Umar's website. Go to idontwantpoisonivy.com. Okay. And he'll help you find somebody in your area or train someone in your area. But if it's something you think you can do yourself, do a little bit every day. Use the plastic bags. Don't touch anything where the IV is going to get on it and then reinfect mm-hmm. things, because you wouldn't believe people would get poison IV for years afterwards because they touched a doorknob or they pet their dog or they, you know, something like that. And just be careful, go slowly and pull from wet soil. And just be aware that you'll always have new plants popping up, especially around doorways and stuff, because birds eat the berries in the fall, and then they roost on areas like your doorway and your gutter, and they poop out the seeds, and so there's always going to be new poison ivy plants. It's a Native American plant. It's always been here.
Okay. That's helpful.
All right.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, Barbara. Oh, you have a good summer.
Thank you. You too. Be well.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce my fall tour schedule. I'll appear at the Delaware Home Show in Newark on Saturday, September 10th, at the Spring City Library on Friday evening, September 30th, and at the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show on October 15th and 16th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with tips on picking top tomatoes and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I'm always telling people that it's okay to harvest tomatoes at the breaker stage when they are showing their first signs of color. Is that correct? Can they possibly ripen up to full flavor? And if so, how should they be cared for after they're picked? We'll answer all those tomato-y questions after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Courtney, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Courtney. Where are you?
I'm in Kinston, North Carolina, close to the coast.
Very good. So beautiful down there.
It is.
What can we do for Courtney in North Carolina?
Well, for the past two seasons, the vine squash borers have torn apart my squash and zucchini plants. I can't seem to get them to grow. and I'm not sure what to do. They come back every year.
Right. Well, they do. And I want to thank you for calling, because we've been talking about this a little bit on the air lately. And I got an email just the other day from a guy named Jonathan in Nebraska, because I kept describing the pest that gets all this started as a night flying moth. And Jonathan sent this just delightful email, very pleasant, you know, one of these, I think you might want to recheck because I'm pretty sure I see them during the day. And sure enough, they are day flying moths, and they're very distinctive looking. They look like wasps or bees. This moth comes into your garden. It has a very specific life cycle. It only lays its eggs at the base of squash vines that are hollow inside. Some squashes, some winter storage squashes, they have solid stems, and the moth is not interested in them. She's interested in zucchini and pumpkins and other stems that are hollow, because she's going to lay these little eggs. A tiny little caterpillars are going to hatch out, and then they're going to crawl inside the vine. But at this stage, they're so small, you can't see them. You can't see any damage to the vine. And then the caterpillar goes inside, and then it eats like mad and gets really big. But by the time you notice something is wrong, typically the plant looks like it's wilting from lack of water, there's a big honking caterpillar inside that's really ravaged your vine. Now, have you been aware that this is the life cycle?
Not until last week when I started kind of reading into it, trying to figure out why all my plants were dying. And when I went to pull the plants up, literally the base of it just...
Yeah, just came apart, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
People who have voles, V-O-L-E-S, they have that experience with their hostas. Their hostas don't look good, and they pull at them, and they find that that's all there is. There's nothing below ground. Now, you're in North Carolina. Have you been putting plants in the ground, or do you direct seed these crops?
I did it both ways this year. I had a few that I direct seeded, and I had two plants, and they ate them all.
Right, right, because you didn't do anything to protect them.
Right.
You know, a fast-growing zucchini, you can, and what did they, was it all zucchini that they got, all summer squash?
Two zucchini plants and four squash plants.
Okay.
Four summer squash.
So your zucchini is a summer squash. So you might still have time in your climate. Now, mm-hmm. The interesting thing, do you still have leftover seed?
Yes.
Okay. So get some nice seed starting mix. Get some old garden six packs. Put the, you know, two seeds each in each cell. Water them. Keep them warm until they sprout. And then start cutting back on the water, mm-hmm. and then grow them in a protected area. You know, put them out in the sun where you can see them, but don't put them in the ground right away. And then when they're about a month old, get medical gauze. You know, when not medical tape, not a Band-Aid, but you know when you get a real bad cut on your arm or something, they'll wrap gauze around it?
Yes.
So wrap gauze from where the roots come out of the bottom of the stem up to the first leaf. If the first leaf is pretty close, pull that off, because okay. Obviously the plants are going to grow. And just wrap medical gauze one layer loosely, and then go out and plant these replacement plants out in your garden so that the gauze is like an inch below ground and covers 2 or 3 inches above ground. Believe it or not, that should be enough to protect your plants. There's also a possibility that by the time you get these crops ready and put them out, that the life cycle won't be at the right stage anymore, that these creatures won't be flying around.
Okay.
Because they generally come out early in the season. And one thing you may have read in your articles is late planting may
yeah.
prevent them coming around, which in your area, it's a mitzvah because you're still growing easily into Halloween and things are growing pretty strong.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you should have plenty of time to get some late season. It'll be fall squash. You'll be inventing a new garden crop. It won't be summer squash.
Right, absolutely.
So in the future, just don't direct seed any squashes that have hollow vines. Always grow from starts and always wrap the vine to protect it.
Okay, absolutely. I will do that.
All right. All right, good luck, Courtney, and enjoy.
Thanks, Mike.
Enjoy your beautiful summer at the beach.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Wayne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Wayne. How are you?
Good, thanks.
And where is Wayne good?
I'm in Riverton, New Jersey.
What can we do for Wayne in Riverton?
I am looking to get some advice on planting a hedge in my house, our new house, something that would provide some privacy.
Okay.
Well, we just moved into our new house, and our lots are relatively narrow, and I would like to plant something as a hedge that would provide privacy so I don't have to see my neighbor's driveway.
Okay.
The yard, the side which I'm looking to plant is on the front yard on the north side facing east, facing west, I mean. And what I had considered previously is my old house had a holly tree, but mm-hmm. then I'm not thinking that the holly tree would be adequate because it'd be too big. I was thinking of holly bushes, but I'm told that they don't grow very fast, and I was told to maybe grow arborvitae, but I don't know if that will. Hopefully it's something that's hardy because it's right adjoining my neighbor's driveway.
Okay. Hollies are great plants for this, and as you were told correctly, hollies come in every shape, size, and form. There's the American holly that has a very open, very Christmas tree kind of shape, and there is every kind of holly shrub. And depending on the length of the area you want to cover, you would want to get some pretty mature plants. Yes, they grow slowly, but you can also buy them at almost any size. Investing in good quality plants up front can save you a world of trouble down the line. One thing with hollies you'd have to remember is you need male pollinator plants if you want to get berries on the female plants. So really, you only need like one male plant in there. But if you don't have one male plant in there or somewhere in the neighborhood, you won't get those berries that are part of the fun. Arborvitae are the typical evergreen screening trees. They get very tall. There are dwarf varieties, but most of them get very tall. They are kind of prone to ice and snow damage, and they are a favorite of deer. So if you're going to go with arborvitae, you would want to choose your varieties very carefully. There are a couple that grow more slowly because, I mean, otherwise you're talking about 20, 30-foot tree after a couple of years. And again, they're very prone to winter damage, so you'd want a very high-quality dwarf tree. And there are even some that are said to be pretty deer resistant. But I'll tell you, the plants that I recommend for this purpose are ornamental grasses. Those giant grasses that grow, they grow very fast. They grow very full. They're very colorful. Some of them have plumes at the top. And they do go dormant over winter, but they do grow again in the spring. And they form a very impenetrable barrier. You even have to be careful pruning them. Some of the leaves are very sharp. But they make a great look. They grow quickly. They grow easily. And they're relatively trouble-free. Again, you would want to make sure there are one or two varieties that are considered invasive because of the seeds and their plumes. So you want to avoid those. But you would find a good selection of well-behaved ones around. I think they would give you the most screening, the quickest, the best bang for your buck, so to speak.
Is there any particular one that would be better?
I'm not that good at keeping up with varieties and stuff. This is where you would do a little bit of research online. And really, there's one or two types out there that you want to avoid, the ones that are invasive. So you're just looking for well-behaved ones. Even well-behaved ones are going to grow tall and fat and very fast. In a season, they'll be 5 foot tall and 5 foot wide. I mean, they'll give you everything you need.
Oh, okay. That sounds okay. The reason I was thinking of the holly is that I love the berries. They're pretty, but they have the thorns, and people don't like to walk by them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the hollies are a good idea, too. You got a lot to choose from. Go online, print out pictures of them, really think about what they'll look like, and then be ready to plant in the fall. You don't want to put any of this stuff in over the summer. It's too hot.
Okay.
Okay, good luck, Wayne.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. James, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hello there, Mike. Well, I've got a problem. I'm from Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Oh, James, that's not that much of a problem. I know people with much worse problems than that.
Guess it depends on where you live there.
Yeah.
So a couple years back, I had a lawn service come in to spray my yard, do all that. Up until this point, I never really had a problem with my yard, just some regular weeds and stuff. And then probably about a year later, I started to see Japanese stilt grass, you know, a little bit. But every year gotten worse, now to the point where I have a yard almost completely of Japanese stilt grass. Any bare spot on the yard has Japanese stilt grass. And I figure probably in about 2 or 3 years, I won't have any grass except for a Japanese stilt grass yard.
So how shady is your lawn?
Some areas are very shady.
Yeah. Japanese stilt grass is a plant that can really only do well in soaking wet soil and pretty shady conditions. So your lawn care service didn't have anything really to do with this. This stuff is all over our environment. And if you're trying to grow grass in an area that drains poorly and doesn't get enough sun, the grass can't thrive and something's going to come in. And in this case, it's the Japanese stilt grass. And what kind of grass are you trying to grow in those shady areas?
Just the perennial rye.
Okay. What? No, not just perennial rye. That would not be a good choice. That's a full sun grass. How much sun does it get, the worst spots?
Oh, that area is in the shade quite often.
Okay, so here's the deal. Let's cut to the chase. Any areas that you have that get 4 hours of sun a day or more can grow a lawn grass. Anything less than that, you're going to have to put in some sort of moss or shade-loving ground cover because there is no lawn grass that can tolerate less than 4 hours of sun a day. So Japanese stilt grass is very shallow-rooted. It pulls out very easily. It's also a summer annual that's going to die over the winter time. So at the end of this season, hopefully during a really wet spell, I suggest you have a pulling party. Throw a barbecue party, get some good beer, get some good soft drinks, get some good stuff on the grill, invite some friends over, give them good gloves, and if it's not wet, soak that lawn for like 24 hours beforehand and have them slowly pull out the clumps of Japanese stilt grass and pile it all up somewhere. You will be amazed at how easy it comes.
Oh, it comes up easy.
Yes. And you get some extra hands, you get it all out, and then you've got this all arranged. In the areas where you can grow grass, then you want to very soon after that have a big load of compost or topsoil delivered. Spread that over those areas, including the areas that are good grass, and then sow seed that contains at least some fine fescues.
Okay.
Fine fescues are the most shade-loving grass.
Okay.
But you'll sow the new seed at the end of August, and it will establish real well. And then in the spring, you'll pull up, you know, any little rogue things of stilt grass as soon as you see them. And if you take good care of the lawn, that means never cutting it lower than 3 inches, never feeding it chemical fertilizers, especially in the summer, and returning the clippings to the lawn. If you have 4 hours of sun, those areas should stay stilt grass free if you get it all out and then reseed heavily in the fall.
Okay. Now, my problem, I have a very large yard.
Well,
acres.
Then you don't need all of that, right? It's not like you're using all of it. Work the area around your house that you use as a lawn that you see all the time, and the rest, just keep it mowed real well. If it's directly attached to your lawn, make an area where you're going to try to keep a nice-looking lawn and drive deep edging into the ground to prevent the stilt grass from crossing over.
Okay.
Now, unless you're a golf course, you don't need 4 acres of lawn.
Got that right.
You know, just mow it.
All right.
All right.
I'll put my kids to work.
Yeah. Kids,
they're
friends.
They're all for the summer.
Kid, well, and again, but do it at the end of the summer when you have
okay.
these bare spots and then you want to reseed right away.
Okay.
No time in between.
Alrighty.
All right. Good luck, James.
Thank you very much. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone who listens to this show via our podcast that our originating station, WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, picks up the costs that keep our show both on the air and on your device. Hint, hint. Becoming a member of WHYY directly supports You Bet Your Garden. We'll even send you a mug. Darn nice mug, too. But don't go looking for all the details at the support section of WHYY.org just yet, because we'll be right back with Titanic tomato picking tips and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, describing exactly what goes on inside a tomato as it ripens up on the vine, and telling you when it's safe to take that tomato off the vine and get full flavor. And tell you about some things that you can accidentally do to ruin that flavor. It's a jam-packed question of the week, and it's coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Alice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hey,
I've
Alice.
I've listened to you for so long. I'm so dying to ask this question.
Okay, I'm dying to ask you a question.
So I'm over in Westchester.
Wait a minute. Oh, okay. That was my question. Where are you?
I'm over in Westchester, right in your backyard.
Okay.
And we have a mower, a big John Deere, a mulching mower. And it's been our practice to, I'm weeding the flower beds and my husband's mowing and riding around on that thing. And he says, yeah, just throw the weeds in the yard and I'll mulch them. And it's pretty weedy in our lawn. So I'm wondering if I'm planting weeds by doing this.
Well, that's an interesting concept because in the fall, do you get leaves that fall on the lawn?
Yeah.
And he does mulch those into the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's excellent. That is returning the clippings to the lawn is the best thing you can do for a lawn because the grass clippings are 10% nitrogen. And they're a perfect natural lawn food. I just reread an old study that reminded me that over the course of a season, returning the clippings to 1 acre of lawn supplies 260 pounds of nitrogen to the lawn.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's very significant. And the reverse is true. People who remove their clippings are starving their poor lawns to death.
Oh, hmm.
Now, the issue with the weeds, that's more complex. I can see ways where that would work, but I think you'd have to follow the same rule as most people follow with composting, in that you don't want to use weeds that show obvious signs of disease or weeds that have gone to seed.
Okay.
So if it's early in the season and it's just a young weed and just flower buds forming on it, and he mows it over, and he mulches it into a billion little pieces, and it goes into the turf, I don't see how that could hurt. If you start pulling dandelions that are fully flowered, that are making puffballs or something like that, then yes, he is weed seeding the lawn.
Okay. But it sounds like the chickweed should not come to the party.
Oh, good Lord. No, no, no. Chickweed is always going to seed. You know, chickweed is just one of those kind of girls. It's just always dropping seed all over the place. That's one year I didn't have a chance to really weed my garden beds over the winter, and people asked me what that was. And I said, oh, that's my cover crop, you know, because it went from one end of the bed to the other. So if you see the weeds in the lawn that are the weeds you pulled, then obviously they're being transferred. Because generally you're going to get different types of weeds in a lawn than you are in a garden bed.
And that's exactly why I was asking. Okay, well, that is excellent.
Now, if you have a lot of weeds in the lawn, the best thing to do is make sure he's not cutting the lawn too short. That grass has to be 3 inches when he's done cutting it. And you can't trust any markings on the side of the mower, or everybody has always told me, oh, it's ratcheted up as high as it can go. And then they'll send me an email and it's a dirt road. I mean, there's, you know. So make sure the grass is 3 inches high after he's done cutting it. Don't let him feed it anything in the summer if it's a cool season grass. A matter of fact, if he's mulching the leaves in the fall and returning the clippings, he might not have to feed it at all. And if there's a lot of chickweed in the lawn, and he's got this Gigundus mower, has he ever had the lawn core aerated?
No.
Then this is an ideal time to plan right around the 1st of September, between the 1st and the 15th, have somebody come out with one of these machines that pulls plugs out of the lawn and do a core aeration. Chickweed is a sign of wet soil, poorly draining soil, compressed soil, compacted soil. And pulling these plugs out, even though it's an indirect method, will help the lawn thrive and the chickweed won't like it. And then he can actually go and mow over those little cores and do the kind of thing he loves to do. That's perfectly okay.
Okay, that is so reassuring. Well, I will definitely be doing that. Thank you.
All right, my pleasure. Good luck.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. you're easier to get a hold of than the U.S. Extension Service.
Hey, Jack, where are you located? What is your extension service?
Penn State, unfortunately. They don't return telephone calls. But let's talk about what I want to, and that's whether or not put wood ashes around lilac trees.
Okay, that's an easy answer. Are you in Penn State or just near it?
I'm near.
Okay. Do you burn wood for the winter and you're looking for a use for all this ash?
Right.
One of the firmest rules of gardening is that if you have a lot of something, it's probably not a good idea to use it in the garden. Lilacs are acid-loving plants if they want a specialized pH, like azaleas and rhododendrons. Too much wood ash would actually kill them. I can't imagine a situation whereby wood ash would be good for lilacs. And if you get too clever about it, it can really kill the plant. What lilacs need is really good airflow. They need to be in an uncrowded situation. They need to get the earliest rays of the morning sun, and they need to be pruned shortly after they finish flowering in the spring. For instance, I really wanted to prune my lilacs down low to improve the airflow. They had gotten a little crowded at the base. So I took out a good number of branches about a month ago. And they also need a lot of sun. When I planted them, they were kind of in the shade of a little bit of the house and some trees. And I thought I just wasn't doing the right thing. And when they finally got tall enough, now I get dozens and dozens of beautiful, heavily scented flowers every spring. But the only thing I've ever put at their base is a little bit of peat moss to keep their soil acidic and some compost to keep them happy. The only real good use for wood ash is if you have a lawn that's growing in acidic soil. Do you have a lawn?
I do.
Do you ever have it tested to see what...
Well, I've tried. Like I said, the Extension Service of Penn State doesn't communicate very well.
Well, really, if all you need to do, you can even do it online, is to get a test kit, you mail it in with your soil sample, and they'll send you back a reading. You can also buy electrical meters and test strips at garden centers that'll tell you the pH. That's the real important thing with a lawn. And if your pH is low, you know, 7 is right around the middle, that's normal. Lawns grow really well at 6.5 to 7. But if your pH is down at 6 because it's you have naturally acidic soil, that is a great place to spread your wood ash in the spring. And and you would spread that wood ash instead of lime. It has the exact same effect as lime. Lime raises the soil pH. So if you have an acidic soil that you want higher, you add some wood ash or lime. If you have something growing in soil that needs it very acidic, blueberries, azaleas, rhododendrons, lilacs, you want to keep any kind of wood ash or lime away and maybe add some peat moss or compost.
Well, it's really difficult to keep lime away here in central Pennsylvania. There's outcroppings of it, you know, almost on every farm. So.
Right. You have limestone soil, so that's why it would be good to get the soil tested to see, you know, in Pennsylvania in general, we have slightly acidic soils because we're an area of high rainfall. But it's quite possible that your limestone balances everything out and you have like the perfectly neutral soil without doing anything. And then it becomes tough to use up your wood ash. Then, you know, then you just got to get it to somebody who doesn't have lime soil and has a lawn.
Very much.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Yep. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. How tomatoes ripen and when to pick them. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. Get us started with this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. John in Texas, Zone 9A, southwest of Houston, writes, I've been hearing you talk about tomatoes splitting as a response to heavy rain following dry times. Does this debunk the theory that the fruit stopped taking in nutrition after ripening has started? I had always heard that the first break in color signaled that abscission had occurred and the fruit had been cut off from receiving additional nutrition from the main plant. If tomatoes that are ripening split after a heavy rain, does this mean that they are not completely abscised from the plant? On another note, what's your take on picking tomatoes at the first signs of ripening versus waiting a little longer? The mockingbirds, our state bird down here in Texas, are killing me when I try to wait.
Mocked by mockingbirds, how poetic. At any rate, I have long told gardeners that once a tomato starts to color up, it's no longer taking nutrition from the vine and can be removed to ripen up completely indoors. But you know, it's been a long time since I double-checked the research on that suggestion. So I went back to my original source, an excellent article we published about tomato ripening in Organic Gardening magazine during my time as editor-in-chief, when everything in every article was rigorously and independently researched and fact-checked.
And you found?
A perfect explanation of the tomato ripening process in a story that was written back then by our managing editor, Vicki Mattern, and Scott Meyer, who is now the editorial director for Grow, the magazine that members of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society receive as one of their many benefits.
Benefits like tickets to the Philadelphia Flower Show.
Yep, membership has its benefits. Now, and I quote, tomatoes have two distinct growth phases, cell division and cell enlargement. Shortly after the flower is pollinated, the tomato feverishly produces and reproduces cells. After a few weeks, the peak number of cells is reached, and then each individual cell begins to grow larger. This process eventually reaches its peak as the, quote, immature green tomato reaches its full size.
Then it starts to ripen?
Yes. Specifically, the fruit will slowly lose the green color of its chlorophyll as the carotenoids and lycopene that give it its final colors begin to develop. Most ripening tomatoes will go from a deep green to a lighter green, then almost yellow. Tomatoes that are destined to be red when they're ripe will develop a few pink streaks down at the blossom end, while tomatoes that are destined to be yellow when ripe will become a brighter shade of yellow.
Are these tomatoes that are showing some color at what you call the breaker stage?
Yeah, and tomatoes that have reached the breaker stage will finish ripening up off the vine with full flavor or close to it, as long as you don't screw it up.
I know that one way to ruin things is to put the tomatoes in a sunny windowsill. You always warn people that only the leaves of the plants need sun, not the fruits, and that direct sun can cook the flavor right out of a tomato.
And you know, the same thing happens if you don't pick ripe tomatoes promptly outdoors. They can lose a lot of flavor sitting out on the vine once they're dead ripe. Now, the other extreme to avoid is a chill. A food scientist at the University of Maryland, we quoted in that story, warned that ripening tomatoes will taste mealy and have little flavor if they're exposed to temperatures below 55 degrees. The ideal temperature for ripening up breaker tomatoes indoors is between 60 and 65 degrees.
That's why you should never put any tomatoes in the fridge. Ever, 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 ever. Now, our listener uses the word abscission. What does that mean?
When something becomes physically disconnected, like when a fruit is picked or falls from a plant, a branch is pruned, or in humans, circumcision, when...
Okay, enough, I get it.
It's a word you see a lot in horticultural articles about tomatoes. He's using it in a more theoretical sense, following the concept that a ripening tomato is no longer attached to the plant, in the sense that it's not absorbing any more nutrients.
So then a breaker tomato shouldn't split if it hasn't already.
Well, I had to swim through some of the most intense scientific research I've ever tried to read to figure this out. But it seems that the reverse is true. Because the ripening tomato is no longer actively taking in nutrients, excess water comes through unimpeded and may actually lead to worse splitting. And pruning your tomato plants, this bizarre concept of removing healthy branches and leaves, leads to worse splitting because now there's less biomass for all that excess water to go into.
So this is one of those easy questions that had you reading footnotes and citations all day.
You'd think I'd loin. Anyway, everybody agrees that tomatoes that have turned color and are already actively ripening can be taken off the vine and brought inside, where they should achieve full flavor if they're kept out of direct sunshine in an area that stays around 65 degrees. Well, that sure was lots of interesting information about coaxing your love apples through their final days of ripeness, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots more articles about tomatoes, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pick my brandy wines before their time. If I don't get out of this studio, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please include your location, especially if you are certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to email us about, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Lynn is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar keep our website right. Our intrepid intern, Emma Bixler, is right at the breaker stage. Ready to pick, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Green Al Banks is our editor. Get it? Green Al Banks? Al Green? You know Al Green? Anybody? Can I get a witness? I'm your misunderstood soul singer, Mike McGrath, reminding you that the word of the day is abscission. Can you say that, cats and kittens? And did you know you can sing it to the tune of tradition from Fiddler on the Roof? Amaze your friends, confuse your enemies, get the house clean before sundown on Friday. And I'll see you next week. Abscission!
Tradition!
If your squash and zucchini plants are wilting, blame a pest, not the heat. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll have an update on that most unseen of garden foes, the squash vine borer. Plus answers to all your growing questions.